Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Say you're about to hail a cab, but let's be imaginative here. It's not just any cab. It's a spaceship cab. Come on, stay with me. So you get in, and the first thing you need to do is tell the pilot where you're going. And start with the familiar parts, right? Comm Ave, Boston, Massachusetts, United States. But that's when things get weird. Earth, Milky Way, Virgo Supercluster, Universe, Multiverse? It's the weird cosmic part of the address. That's the part that excites MIT professor and science writer Marsha Bartuszak and helped inspire her new book, Dispatches from Planet 3. Get it? Planet 3? 32 brief tales on the solar system, the Milky Way, and beyond. Marsha, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. You've not sat across from me, but I gather you've sat across from other people in this chair.
And I've always enjoyed it.
Well, I hope you enjoy this too. So, it's a book of essays, a book of stories, a book about the overlooked and underappreciated souls who made modern science. What made you want to tell these 32 stories?
In my career, I have covered the frontiers of astrophysics, and then over the last decade, I have done some history, dipping into topics like the birth of modern cosmology and the history of black holes. I wanted to put the two together. I wanted to take a new exciting finding and provide the backstory. So all of these essays are taking something new, a new idea, a new discovery, and showing that it had an origin and a seed in the past. I wanted to show people how these discoveries came to be.
Well, it does. You give a sense of the human history. I mean, I've got my favorites, and I'm going to make you talk about my favorites because that's how this works.
All right, there's 32. We can't possibly talk about all 32.
But do you have any that stand out? Was there something you learned along the way that sticks with you?
Well, something that I noticed as I was putting these essays together is giving credit where credit is due. There are a lot of people that have dropped off the radar, one of which is we always give Edwin Hubble credit for discovering the expanding universe.
We've named some things after him.
And yes, the Hubble constant, the Hubble law, a Hubble telescope. But it turns out that there were two other people who were just as important, and their names are not in the history books, not or in the general public. One was a Lowell Observatory astronomer, Vesto Slipher, who actually provided the velocity data that Hubble used in his famous 1929 paper that gave him such a fame. But Hubble did it without giving Slipher credit.
So it's not just like standing on the shoulders of giants, it's not acknowledging that you were standing on
the shoulders. Pushing them aside and getting all the credit for yourself. I think it should be the Hubble-Slipher constant.
Are you lobbying for that?
Yes, I am campaigning, especially as the 100th anniversary is going to be coming up in the next decade.
Well, let's talk about Chapter 4, where you bring us the story of Percival Lowell. You may recognize that name, Lowell, if you're familiar with Massachusetts history.
Yes. And
how he brought the idea of water on Mars a century ago into the public conversation. Let's start with this character.
Oh, he is. I mean, it's a fascinating story. He is one of the Boston Brahmins. He was independently wealthy. And he graduated from Harvard, went and traveled in Asia, wrote some books. But then he became passionate about astronomy and decided to use his wealth to build his own private observatory.
As one does
in Flagstaff, Arizona. And he was obsessed with the planet Mars. Just around that time.
This is what time? What?
This was in the 1890s. Okay. Just a decade or so before, there was an Italian astronomer, Giovanni Schiaparelli, who had noticed these streaks on Mars, and he called them, in Italian, canali, which meant channels. Now, Schiaparelli thought of them as some geologic process, But others jumped onto this name, Canali, and said, oh, they are intelligent beings that are building
canals,
waterways.
Like yes. When you build, canals are something you build, man-made waterways.
And Percival Lowell became the biggest champion of this idea and used his observatory to expand on this. And he, in the 1890s, used his 24-inch telescope to look at Mars, and he drew these elaborate maps filled with canals, more than 100 waterways. Showing how these intelligent beings were funneling water from the poles and covering the planet and growing vegetation. It was tremendously popular. Now, the professional astronomy community hated this idea. And
well, because it was based on him turning sort of little errors in his telescope into whole channels and a civilization
exactly,
on a distant world.
Exactly, exactly. Because the professional community was not seeing the same things. But the public ate it up. In fact, the Wall Street Journal at one point said that his findings were the news story of the year.
I mean, it's a kind of a cautionary tale for popular science writing then and now, presumably.
Yeah, but, you know, there's an irony to this story. Upon his death, of course, this idea went away, especially when the Mars orbiters and the rovers showed that Mars was a totally barren landscape, no life at all. But it did show proof that in the past, like 3 billion years ago, Mars did have flowing water over the landscape. And there are remnants, fossils of those old channels. And I always wonder how Lowell would have felt about that.
The actual discovery of water.
Yes.
So wait. Also, just moving on, right? You've written a whole book about the concept of black holes. And it's also the topic of one of the essays here. And you ask a question which turns out to be pretty bleak, as we'll get to in a second, but it never even occurred to me, and it should have, which is, where does this term black hole come from? It seems so natural and so inevitable, but of course it's not inevitable. Where does it come from?
For decades, people always credited the great Princeton theorist John Wheeler that they said he did it, and he did. He, in a 1967 talk, he used it. He used the term black hole. Before that, they were always called gravitationally collapsed objects. Not as catchy. Not as catchy. And he used it in the speech, and it just took off. But it turns out Wheeler was not the first to use it. It actually was used by a Life magazine writer in 1963. He was reporting on an astrophysics conference. A couple weeks later, it was in Science News magazine. Another conference had used the term black hole. And it turns out I traced it to this one physicist, Hung Yi Chu. And I contacted him, and I said, you must have been the one who created the term black hole. In fact, he was the one who created the term quasar. So I thought for sure I had it. And he said no. He said he actually got it a few years before. He had attended a conference in the early 1960s with Robert Dickey, another Princeton theorist, who used the term. He was discussing gravitationally collapsed objects and said, it's like the black hole of Calcutta. And he's the one who put it into the atmosphere, and eventually Wheeler adopted it. But it is Dickey who did it, in fact.
And that Calcutta is the clue also, right? Black hole of Calcutta.
Calcutta is the infamous 18th century prison where prisoners would go in and they would not come out.
So it's like think of it as being sent to the hole in prison. This
exactly.
is sort of where it comes from. The black hole was this prison space where people went and died. And that name migrated to the star.
To the stars, yes.
It's kind of bleak and amazing story that you dug out there. So many of the essays in the collection highlight lesser-known heroes, including a number of female astronomers who just aren't household names like Einstein or Hubble. And I want to ask, before we talk about one of them in particular, is it inspiring to dig up these stories or is it depressing?
I think it's inspiring. And it wasn't my agenda. This is what was interesting, because I did these series of essays over a number of years, and I didn't realize until I put them into a collection that there were all these women. A good quarter of the book When I go to look at the backstory, there the women are. They just weren't in the spotlight. There was Vera Rubin, who found evidence for dark matter. There was Beatrice Tinsley, who I like to think of as the Darwin of astronomy. She proved that galaxies evolve over time from bright to dimmer. There was Cecilia Payne, who in the 1920s proved that hydrogen was the main element of the universe until she was told to take it out of her thesis.
Well, that's the depressing side of
things.
So many of these stories involve women who made incredible discoveries that were then buried either deliberately or accidentally.
But sometimes there is a correction of the passage. And I feel I'm bringing this to the plate. It just happened a couple weeks ago. Jocelyn Bell Burnell, founder of the discoverer of the neutron star, did not get the Nobel Prize. Her advisor got the Nobel Prize. But just recently, she got the big breakthrough prize, $3 million. I think that makes up for a little non-credit in the past.
So let's name another of these forgotten women scientists. Henrietta Swan Leavitt?
Leavitt.
Leavitt. Working in the late 1800s at the Harvard Observatory. Who was she? What did she do there?
She was one of Harvard College Observatory's infamous computers. The director, Edward Pickering, knew that there were all these smart women around with science degrees, and he would hire them to analyze the data that his male astronomers were collecting. As he liked to brag, he could get all these smart women for half the amount of money, half the pay. They got 25 cents an hour. And Henrietta Leavitt was a specialist in variable stars. That's what her task was, to look out for variable stars. And she found more than 2,000 over her lifetime.
These are stars whose brightness varies.
They vary. Are stars at a certain stage in their life. They're breathing in and out, and they get brighter and dimmer, brighter and dimmer. And she found a specific pattern that enabled astronomers to use it as a standard candle, a cosmological yardstick, to measure distances far more distant than they'd ever been able to do before.
Because, again, this is a question to think about, but like, how do we know how far away some of these stars are? This was a key moment
in figuring
that out. This
was an absolute key moment. In fact, her discovery allowed Harlow Shapley to show the real size of the Milky Way, and also that we're kicked off to the side. And Edwin Hubble could not have discovered that there were other galaxies beyond the Milky Way without Leavitt's law. And so she is terribly important. In fact, she was nominated for a Nobel Prize for this achievement. But unfortunately,
after she died,
the person did not know that she had died, and so she could not get such an award.
It was a touching moment in your book. Can I ask you quickly, if there's something on the frontier of science that you are most looking forward to at the moment, somewhere you keep your eyes in the sort of cosmological research or the physics research?
I am wanting to find the dark matter. I have first reported on that. I was one of the first to write on this in the early 1980s. At that time, it was known as the missing mass, now known as
the
dark one.
This is the stuff that seems to be pushing galaxies apart.
Well, that's the dark energy.
Oh, thank you.
Dark matter is there's this extra invisible material. They know, they see it gravitationally. They know that the galaxies are surrounded by this extra material. It cannot be ordinary matter, but they think it's something mysterious. I want to know what it is.
Well, I want to have you on when they figure it out so you can explain it to me. That's Marcia Bartuszak. She's a science writer and professor at MIT. Her new book is Dispatches from Planet 3, 32 Brief Tales on the Solar System, the Milky Way, and Beyond. She'll be at Harvard Bookstore event on Wednesday, October 17th. Thank you, Marcia. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.